shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and the DeNicholas Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And I am joined today by former prosecutor for the state's attorney's office, Loretta Frelick, my wonderful co-host. Loretta, how are you?
Well, I'm good, Mary. I'm glad to be here where it's nice and calm.
Yes. Yeah. You've had a crazy weekend, I understand.
Yes. We had the fire department for the smoke from my microwave whole building.
Oh, no.
We had a flood and movers who didn't show up. But God is good.
But other than that, it was
perfect.
God is good. Well, thank you for showing up today after all this.
And you were the host of several panels at the Notre Dame event.
Right, the DeNicholas Center for Ethics and Culture, where I'm so fortunate to be involved as a fellow. The Cardinal Francis George Fellow there has a wonderful conference every fall. And listeners, if you want 4 days of just tremendous education and fellowship and edification and inspiration, I would really suggest you sign up for the DeNicholas Center Fall Conference. We had about 900 people, and speakers included Marianne Glendon, the Harvard Law professor who was the ambassador to the Holy See, her daughter Elizabeth Lev, who is a world-renowned art historian who's stationed in Rome but came in to give a really interesting presentation on, for the year of St. Joseph, the figure of St. Joseph in liturgical art and in art in churches and stuff. And it was fascinating to see the way how artists in the church depicted St. Joseph and how that evolved over the centuries. So into the St. Joseph we kind of know and love and see today. So she spoke, and then I was honored to be asked to moderate a panel between former U.S. Congressman Dan Lipinski from Illinois' 3rd Congressional District and Joseph Sella, who was the former U.S. ambassador to Fiji and Tonga. Wow. So that was very interesting. And, you know, both of them very devout, sincere Catholic men who gave some reflections on public service and the Catholic faith. And I was just really so impressed by both the remarks that they had to offer. Ambassador Sella spoke a great deal about what's been going on in China, which, of course, he knows because of some of the diplomatic work that he did. And everything's worse than you thought, Loretta. That's the, you know. And then Congressman Lipinski about, you know, the moral decisions he had to make that he knew could likely cause him to lose his seat, which, of course, he did lose his seat. And it was really sweet to see so many students coming up to him afterwards telling him he should run again.
Yes.
So we'll see. We should pray for that, listeners. I don't know if he's listening, but if he is, he's got two big supporters here. But, you know, that takes a lot. A person to run for public office and to run for office, especially right now when you can be destroyed in a moment's notice.
With a nanosecond.
Yep. And, you know, we're going back to high school yearbooks and God knows what else to find dirt on people. And it's
and all it takes is a rumor, Mayor. It's not even the truth.
Yep. Yeah. And you can pull any obscure tweet off of Twitter. It's just awful. So it's but Congressman Lipinski really did encourage people to run for office themselves. Like, nothing is going to change unless somebody steps up and does it. And we can't all be afraid.
Nope.
And so at any rate, so that was a really terrific conference, too. But well, speaking of events and conferences and things all pro-life, we are really privileged to have with us for the next for this segment, Amy Gerke, who is the executive director of Illinois Right to Life. former official at Wisconsin Right to Life, but has now crossed the Cheddar Curtain and is on our side here. And Lord knows there's a lot more work to be done in Illinois on this issue than there is on the Wisconsin side of the border. But Amy, are you with us? Amy, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, terrific, terrific. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Can we start by I want to ask you, because I had to be in South Bend at this conference I was just referencing, how did your big event go on Friday night? Can you tell our listeners about it?
Sure. On Friday night, we had the 48th Annual Banquet for Illinois Right to Life Action, which is the C4 lobbying arm of Illinois Right to Life. This is the arm that is in Springfield fighting against our crazy pro-abortion legislators who are, you know, seeking to do harm to our state and our women and our babies. So it was wonderful. We had the largest event we've ever had. We had well over 400 people.
Wow.
Yes, we had former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Robert Thomas come speak to the crowd, and he was absolutely fantastic. Talked about his years as a Chicago Bear, as well as his years on the Illinois Supreme Court. We also awarded our first Young Pro-Life Activist of the Year award to Evita Duffy. She's a University of Chicago student who faced intense backlash after she had the audacity to suggest that socialism might kill more people than COVID will, that might destroy America faster than COVID ever could. So she was very well received. It was just a great evening, lots of wonderful pro-life people. It's always, here in Illinois, after being in Wisconsin for so long, there is never a dull moment, to say the very, very least. But it's so wonderful to have events like that where you see so many wonderful Illinois residents who are so passionate about defending the right to life and who know, like Illinois Right to Life, that we can and we will and we must win our state for life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's been, the listeners have heard me, if they're regular listeners here, I have been very adamant in talking about the decision of the Illinois General Assembly to repeal the Parental Notice of Abortion Act and Governor Pritzker's, frankly, the lies he has been telling about what this repeal is going to mean. I saw him interviewed by Rich Miller at Capital Facts, and why Rich Miller let this stand without challenging it, even after being corrected, I don't know. But Governor Pritzker keeps saying, well, we have to protect these young abused girls, and that's why I'm going to sign this into law, to protect young abused girls who have to tell their parents if they get pregnant. Can you speak a little bit about what the law actually does require?
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that's been just appalling, as you well know, through this whole process is just the misinformation that
I'm just calling them lies now, Amy, because I'm so because I was willing to give people the benefit of the doubt at first if I thought they didn't understand the law, but now they're just lying.
Now, exactly. Yeah, let's call it like it is. They have been lying. So, it's really a very, very common sense law that simply requires that an abortionist notify the parent or other guardian, specified guardian, of a minor girl 48 hours before she has her abortion. In no way, shape, form, or fashion does the young woman have to tell her parents that she wishes to have an abortion. It is the abortion clinic that must do that.
Right.
And there's been just so much that has been so egregious about this. And as I'm sure you've told your listeners before, last March, a Terrence poll was conducted that showed a vast majority of Illinois residents, over 70%, support parental notification laws. And that included over 50% of respondents who identify as pro-choice. So this is something that was a very popular law. The Illinois legislature has ignored the will of their constituents. They've ignored the fact that parents have the basic right to be involved in their children's health care. And one of the biggest things they're ignoring is the vast majority of parents love their daughters and want what's best for them. And they have every right to be involved in such a huge decision as their daughter's abortion. I mean, you have daughters, I have two daughters, and during the floor debate in the House, all I could think about was my two girls, Kendall and Emily, and how innocent they were when they were 10 and 11 and 12 and even 14, 15, and 16. I mean, they needed me. They needed their dad. And it is absolutely outrageous. I mean, there aren't enough strong words to characterize how horrible this vote was for the people of Wisconsin. And the other thing during the floor debate is Anna Mueller and Kelly Cassidy, you know, very pro-abortion state representatives, kept talking about women's health and a women's right to choose and women's bodily autonomy. And it's not women that this repeal is going to help or hurt. Rather, it's little girls. Little girls are going to be hurt
by this repeal. Amy, this is Loretta. I'm Mary's co-host. And
hi.
And as a former prosecutor, I am more concerned. I think what you're saying, the majority of people want what's best for their daughter. The majority of parents are involved with their daughters. But what really distresses me is that you now have criminals that will be able to bring young girls across the state line and will be able to procure an abortion for them. And we're talking girls that are involved in sex trafficking. And I was so impressed with the one girl who responded when before the parental notification had been repealed, who said, "I was sex trafficked. And if the abortion clinic had just been able to call my mom, she might have known where I was." And so we are participating in criminal acts upon the women that come into these clinics. And I don't think we can depend on the clinic to self-report that they had a young girl come in, and I'm not sure the guy is her dad, but, you know.
Absolutely. Well, and the woman you're referring to, Dr. Brooke, she had several forced abortions while she was trafficked as a young teenager, which sadly left her unable to have children. But she said in a very powerful account at a press conference coalition that Illinois Right to Life is part of, she said that if her parents had only known that she was going to have this abortion, they could have found her. She could have been rescued from her sex trafficking so much sooner. And the group Live Action has done an incredible series of videos, undercover videos, showing young women going to abortion clinics, you know, basically recreating the scenario of a young woman being taken to an abortion clinic by her pimp, a minor girl, and the abortion clinic waving her through, ignoring what was obviously going on. And while these videos were not taken in Illinois, we know that this happens. We have no doubt that human trafficking is a huge, huge problem in our state, and it's only going to get worse because parental notice was repealed.
And you also make another point about the fact that this bill did not stop an abortion. This bill only notified the parents who are left with the trauma of the after effects of killing life and possibly bleeding out from a botched abortion. I mean, there are so many reasons why a parent who's going to be stuck with the aftermath of this, you know, emotionally charged. I mean, when you think about what happens in an abortion, when you end the life of the unborn child that has had hormones rushing through that mother's body to that baby, I mean, you are left with a child or a young woman who has all kinds of medical complications, potentially.
Exactly. Yeah.
And parents should be involved.
Yeah. Well, this isn't, you know, it really is even parental involvement. It's just their right to know. And I hope the Democrats, and only Democrats, voted for this bill. Let me just clarify that. I don't want anyone to think I'm unfairly singling a particular party out. But the bill passed with only Democrats voting for it.
You mean there were no Republicans that crossed the line to support parental notification repeal?
The one Republican who got up and spoke probably the most passionately was Representative Chris Boss, who is from, Amy, help me out here.
Northwest.
Elgin, right?
Northwest, out towards the lakes.
Right. Okay. All righty. So, yeah, you don't know. You're not from Illinois originally, so you.
I didn't mean
to throw that out at you.
Here.
But he, prior to his work, his work in the General Assembly, worked as an advocate for an organization that ministered to and supported girls who had been victims of sex trafficking. And he got up and gave probably one of the most incredible talks I've ever seen, and talked about how that he was speaking not only as a legislator, but as a concerned parent, and talked about some of the girls that they had helped through this center where he worked and advocated for. And he talked about how it wasn't speculation. It was a fact. It was a fact that these girls were being trafficked, and that that there were girls in Illinois who, because we had parental notice, were able to be protected and to be brought back to their parents. And boy, he gave a very moving speech. So what I, in addition to his words, which were quite, again, quite moving, I'm also grateful that that's in the record now. And so the General Assembly cannot say it doesn't know. It can't say it didn't know. It knows, and it did it anyway. And I think, I hope that what happened with Glenn Youngkin's victory in Virginia, I hope that resonates with some people in the Democratic Party, that when you start becoming between children and their parents, which is what they have done, you better watch out, because parents, no matter where they stand on the political spectrum, don't like that.
No, exactly. And Illinois Right to Life is absolutely committed to exposing these legislators that supported repeal of parental notice, putting them on notice and making sure that their constituents know that these legislators cared much more about doing the will of the abortion industry than they did about protecting our children, than they did about protecting parents' rights, or even about doing the will of their constituents who overwhelmingly supported parental notice and keeping it in place.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of work ahead of us. We hope that lots of people will help us out, but these legislators must know that we will not stand for this.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all. Illinois Right to Life had so much to do with trying to defeat this bill. And you know, you and I both are aware, because we worked on this, the lies that were told about the bill, so much so, because they knew they couldn't pass it on the merits, right? They knew because they couldn't
win
it up in a straight. And so they took a probate bill and hid this repeal of parental notice in a probate bill. This is the levels to which they will stoop, because this is how powerful the abortion industry is in the state of Illinois, and how much they are able to get away with. Just outright lies. It is, we could go on about this all day. So listeners, if you could just, do us all the favor of trying to find out, if you don't know, Illinois Right to Life can give you this information, how your legislator voted on this, and then send them a quick email or send them something to let them know how you feel about their vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I encourage everybody to go to our website, illinoisrighttolife.org, and sign up for our emails. That is the best way you can know exactly what's going on with all of the life issues, not only in the legislature, but around the state. And we have sent out the roll call vote on the repeal of parental notice, and we will send it out again, because everybody needs to know.
Yeah,
so
terrific.
Please sign up for our emails.
Okay, excellent. Well, moving on then to perhaps a more pleasant topic, the Supreme Court's going to be hearing oral arguments in the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health case. And this is the case, I can't even believe these words are coming out of my mouth, that could potentially overturn Roe versus Wade. And Illinois Right to Life, in conjunction with a couple of other different pro-life groups, is going to have a special sort of listening party. Everyone will be able to listen into the Supreme Court's arguments, the arguments before the court, rather, and then the court's questions on December 1st. And this is really a first. We're going to be able to, anybody can come to this event. Amy, tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, we're really excited about this. As Mary mentioned, this is probably one of the most historic days that we'll see in the pro-life movement in our lifetime.
Yes, this is like Dred Scott or like Brown versus Board of Education. This is a case that comes along once in a lifetime. That's not an exaggeration.
No, not hyperbole whatsoever. I've been doing pro-life work for over 36 years, and I seriously never thought that I would see this day in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I thought, if I worked and worked, and I know you probably feel the same way and other people who've been in this long term do as well, but if we worked and worked, maybe someday our kids and our grandkids would see the day when Roe could possibly be overturned. But here we are. I mean, as bad as things are in Illinois on the national level, we are just at a point where we are on the precipice of having protection restored to preborn babies and their mothers. So to commemorate this day, Illinois Right to Life is having what we're calling a Day of Dobbs, a full day of events surrounding these oral arguments to ensure that people here in Illinois are able to be kept up to date on exactly what's going on in Washington, D.C., and are, you know, just part of the action, part of this momentous day. So we're going to start the day, as you mentioned, with our Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health live listening session and panel discussion. Geez, that's a mouthful. Anyway, that is going to be at 8:30 on Wednesday morning, December 1st, at the Union League Club of Chicago. It's just $25 to attend. You get a lovely breakfast, and we'll be able to listen to the oral arguments as they happen. Even better, there is going to be a wonderful panel. We're still putting it together, but our confirmed speakers right now are Mary Fiorito.
Yay. You get to see me in the flesh. Yeah, I'll sign your program for you. I'll sign your napkin if you come. Come and meet me.
And then we will also have John Green, who is a professor of law at Loyola, as well as Illinois Right to Life's own Steve Jacobs, who authored two advocates' briefs for the Dobbs case. And everybody who's on the panel has had a hand in an amicus brief that was filed to the court. And so they will be listening along with us as we hear these oral arguments take place. And then immediately afterwards, this team of experts will break down exactly, you know, what the court said, what the implications were of the arguments, and people will be able to have their questions answered by this team of experts who, you know, we've got three now, and it's only growing. So this is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime event, you know, to come to a beautiful venue right in Chicago and be in the heart of the action with people who are experts on this case and can answer your questions and let you know exactly what's going on.
Right. And this is, again, and there's other guests that we have invited to be on the panel. I know that Congressman Dan Lipinski is going to make a point to be there as well. Perhaps to give some remarks. I think he's still trying to work out his schedule, but on what it was like to be a member of Congress at a time when, you know, really important pro-life bills were being debated and discussed. And, you know, it's really interesting, I think, to try to get the opinion and the point of view of a legislator who was part of that, you know, it's kind of seeing how the sausage was made. And
right.
as many people know, you know, the incredible lengths that the pro-abortion side would do to try to undermine even the most, you know, modest of pro-life laws were too much, you know, for those who support legal abortion and want to keep it fully funded and no exceptions whatsoever, including exceptions for when, you know, babies can actually feel pain. You know, fetal pain is going to be a big part of our conversation, I think, because one of the falsehoods that the Roe court relied on was that we don't know when life begins. Well, of course, Dr. Jacobs has pointed out that we all know when life begins, and even biologists who say they're pro-choice will agree that life that is human begins at conception. But also, you know, this sort of warped view of fetal pain, that just because it's happening in utero doesn't mean that the child isn't feeling it. And that's the law in that's being debated in Mississippi draws the line for elective abortions. So elective meaning healthy mom, healthy baby at 18 weeks. Or sorry, I take that back, 15 weeks, which is about where pretty much all of the Western world is. And the United States is really the one of only seven countries that allows abortion up until the moment of birth. But, Amy, we need to go to our first break. Can you hang over with us another 5-7 minutes when we get back from the break? Okay, terrific. This is Mary Fiorito along with Loretta Fralick. We are sitting in for Father Anthony. Too many names here. On Winds of Change and the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland, WSFI Catholic Radio on AM 750 and WNDZ on 88.5 FM. Please don't go away.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule, work, or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church. It is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stan's is just off the Kennedy, 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stan's.
I'm Loretta Freilich, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic, social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is conveniently located 1 block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org.
I'm Loretta Freilich with Mary Fiorito, and we are guest hosting for Father Anthony on Winds of Change. And today, our phenomenal guest is Amy Gerke. Amy, I just want to ask you some questions. This event is something I just love because with information comes power. And so many of us pro-life advocates, you know, I find myself, you know, and only because I think I'm my parish's pro-life person, but I find myself, you know, so many people come up and wringing their hands, you know, woe is me, Loretta, what do we do? What's the information on this? And here you are providing not only the information, but that you are also providing experts who will break it down and answer questions for the people that are there. You're providing breakfast so we don't get too unruly. It sounds like a great event. How do we sign up for it?
So it is really easy to sign up. Just visit illinoisrighttolife.org/Dobbs-event. Again, that's illinoisrighttolife.org/Dobbs-event. Or if you forget that URL, just go to the illinoisrighttolife.org website, search Dobbs, and you should find it. So there is a link to register for the event there. Again, it is Wednesday, December 1st at 8:30 a.m. at the Union League Club of Chicago. Nice breakfast will be served, as you mentioned. And I also wanted to mention, in case people are not able to make it in the morning, we truly are making this a day of Dobbs. We will also be having an evening reception at 6 p.m. up in Lincoln Park, and details of this event are on our website as well. $25 to park as well. Valet parking is available. This will be a reception with drinks, hors d'oeuvres, and a chance to talk to Dr. Steve Jacobs and others about the events of the day and ask their questions and so forth as well. So we want to be sure people have two opportunities, you know, both times of day, so they can get out, talk to people, and really learn what's going on with the Dobbs case. And also what exactly what a ruling to either overturn Roe or even just roll back a lot of Roe would mean to the state of Illinois. So I encourage everybody to visit the website, register today, and join us on the 1st.
Now, you said two events. So we hear about the breakfast and the panel. And how long will that run?
So the oral arguments start at 9 a.m. Chicago time. So the event starts at 8:30. People can come, grab their breakfast, grab some coffee, chat with their friends. We'll listen to the arguments, which we expect to last from 9 to 10:30 Chicago time.
Okay.
And then immediately following the arguments at 10:30, we will give a brief rundown. Well, each participant will get a brief rundown of their impressions of the oral argument, their impressions of what was said, and then we will open up the floor to questions from the audience.
And that will last for how long?
Oh, I'm sorry. That will probably last until, I would say, 11:30 or so. And of course, people are able to come as long as they are able to. So
okay.
We encourage everybody to come.
And then the reception that evening, where is that?
That will be in Lincoln Park. More details will be given upon registration. Really easy to get to, valet parking, lovely, lovely venue, and that is from 6 till 7:30 p.m.
Okay, great. Am I ever responsible co-host, Mary, has told me that if you go on the app Spot Hero, it'll take 15% off of your parking. So that's just another helpful piece of information for all our listeners that want to attend.
So excellent. Thank you, Mary. Mary is always on top of it.
I'm the queen of cheap places to park in Chicago, as well as an expert on abortion law and cheap parking. Yeah, so the app is it's a really terrific app that one of my friends turned me on to called Spot Hero. And you just plug in, you know, the venue that you're going to, and it'll show you where the cheapest parking is around, proximate to that venue. In fact, I was in, 2 weekends ago, was in Portland visiting my daughter, and the hotel wanted $55 a night for parking. So I turned on my trusty Spot Hero, and sure enough, for $6.75 a night, I found parking in the garage at Nordstrom, right next door. So I just skedaddled over there. It was a three-minute walk from the hotel and saved me $50 a night. So at any rate, I know sometimes people are intimidated by driving downtown because of parking costs, but this Spot Hero really makes it super, super easy. And all you do is just scan your phone at the parking garage. When you arrive, it lets you in, lets you out. It's terrific. And again, the benefit, yes, anybody could just listen at home to the oral arguments, but the benefit here is that you will have a variety of people who are experts on abortion law, on abortion policy, on medical issues surrounding abortion, on some of the, you know, sociological issues. And they'll all be there. So the minute that the oral arguments are over, we can give prepared remarks and then people can ask questions. And so we're going to have a lot of dialogue back and forth. And of course, you'll be in a room full of like-minded people.
Yes.
Which I think that fellowship and even praying together during the oral arguments will be so important.
And I think that's another really important point to remember. You know, so often in this fight, the devil beats us down and makes us think we're losing, whispers in our ear, nobody cares, you're all alone. And events like this provide that comfort that, you know what, I'm not. Like-minded people who I like to hang around with, who have common sense and faith in God, they're here at this event, and you always are just shored up by being in a company of dread champions that are willing to go the extra mile for the Lord.
Oh, yeah, and Amy, just before we go to our next break and then our second guest, first of all, thank you for coming on and being with us this morning. It's always a joy to go on air with you because we could go on forever, the two of us, and with Loretta in the mix, it's like we really need a whole day. But can you please give us the website where people can find out both about the breakfast and the listening session at the Union Lee Club and then the lovely evening reception in Lincoln Park?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Just visit our website, illinoisrighttolife.org/Dobbs-event. Again, that's illinoisrighttolife.org/Dobbs-event. And again, if you didn't have a chance to write down that URL, just go to illinoisrighttolife.org, do a search for Dobbs, and you will be able to find it. And yeah, I encourage everybody to be there. You know, it is really easy to be discouraged in Illinois, but the reason that I came to this state is I really believe that we can make a change, and there are wonderful pro-lifers in this state, and so much work to be done, but we really believe that it can be done.
Right. Well, I was talking to a friend and just about my utter frustration at parental notice being appealed, and because we're the only state. Now, Illinois is the only state in the country that has ever repealed a parental notice bill. That shows you how extreme we are. But he said to me, you know, the devil always overplays his hand. And so I think that's what happened here in Illinois. I think the devil has overplayed his hand. I don't think the legislators believe that the citizens of the state of Illinois are smart enough to figure out what they did. That's why they hid it in the probate bill. But we have an obligation to make sure that they're aware that we know and that we're telling everyone else what they did.
Absolutely.
Well, Amy, thank you again for giving us so much time. Good luck with the events. And again, listeners, I will be present for that morning session. I'll be on the dais. I'll be one of the speakers as one of the signatories to a Supreme Court brief from professional women that undid the court's argument that women rely on abortion in order to be equal in society. So I'll be there, and Dr. Steve Jacobs and Professor John Labrine of Loyola University School of Law. So we'd love to see you in person. So again, this has been Amy Gerke from Illinois Right to Life. Amy, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Okay.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
I'm Father Tom Coyes, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule, work, or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stan's is just off the Kennedy, 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stan's.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito along with my co-host Loretta Frelick, and we are sitting in today, as we do every Monday, for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change, now the new EWTN Catholic radio voice for Chicagoland. You can hear us both on AM 750 WNDZ and on 88.5 FM at WFSI. And thank you for staying with us because we are we just have a wonderful lineup of guests today. And our second guest is attorney Andrea Picciotti-Bear, who is going to discuss with us the recent oral arguments that the Supreme Court heard about whether or not someone sentenced to death has a right to have not just a minister present with them, but a minister laying hands and praying over them as the execution goes forward. And Andrea is a graduate of Stanford Law School, went to Northwestern undergrad, is a friend to the fabulous, including me, and the mother of 10 children. And Andrea, I don't know how you have time to do it all, but so grateful you could work in some time with us this morning. Welcome.
It's always great to be with you and be back with my friends in Chicago.
Yeah, you're now an official friend of the show, so you get the friend of the show mug. And once I create the friend of the show mug, you'll get one.
And Andrea, you are always invited. Those 10 kids give you a free pass.
No, it's great. And I need mugs. Apparently, I'm only... Friends say, are you drinking enough water? And I'm like, no, but I am drinking enough coffee.
the water of life, right? That's coffee. Well, tell us a little bit about this case, Andrea, because I know you've been following it very closely as someone who is an expert on religious freedom cases.
So it's very interesting. It comes out of Texas. And just in case people are wondering, there are 27 states, and in addition to the federal government, that have the death penalty. Only 21 are actively, I guess, available to execute the death penalty. So this does have pretty significance, not just in Texas, but across the country. And it's a unique request. I am not a fan of the death penalty, but I am a fan when it is going to be employed that there won't be botched executions. And I think that this is an issue where the issues of religious freedom, as well as the importance of the government in making sure that things don't have catastrophic outcomes beyond just, you know, the intended outcome, are ones that we need to consider. So the death row inmate, a man named John Ramirez, was convicted in the early 2000s for the stabbing death of Pablo Castro, who was a convenience store worker out in Corpus Christi, I think it was, and he left in the evening to empty out some trash and was spotted by Ramirez and two of his female companions, robbed for $1.25 out of his pockets. Mr. Castro was a father of nine, and his children were all fairly young at the time. And this has been going on for a number of years. Ramirez fled the country, was in Mexico for a while, and eventually was arrested, was convicted for capital crime, and sentenced to death. He's since then, blessed be God, found religion and has had a relationship that doesn't seem to be made up with a Baptist pastor named Dana Moore. And the pastor now, there's been three execution dates that have been stayed. The most recent one was early September, and it was stayed by the Supreme Court after Ramirez asked for his pastor to not only be in the execution chamber, but as you mentioned, Mary, to lay hands on Ramirez and pray audibly during the execution.
So while he was either, I assume he was receiving an injection rather than, I think Texas still has a couple of other forms of the of capital punishment, do they not?
So this lethal injection is actually by IV.
Okay.
So he isn't, it's not, you know, with an injection itself. It's, you know, he's being hooked up to some IVs where different cocktail of drugs are going to be administered, both first to render him unconscious and then for the execution. And it's very interesting, over the last couple of years, this issue of clergy comfort, as it's come to be known under the law, has been raised. A number of cases before where outside of state-employed chaplains were asking for to be able to administer, you know, be present during an execution, and the Supreme Court has really indicated that we want to make sure that there isn't discrimination, right? Oftentimes, state-employed chaplains are from majority religions, Christian religions, rabbis from Jewish faiths, and so there have been Muslims or Buddhists who have asked for their clergymen, I guess, to be with them at that very delicate moment. And the Supreme Court said, you know, we don't want to be in a situation where minority religions are being treated less favorably. So that's not what's going on in Texas. The pastor is going to be allowed, even though he's not a state chaplain. But it's a delicate issue of how involved and can he actually touch Mr. Ramirez at the moment of his execution. The state raises, in my opinion, some pretty good points, saying, you know, this is a very, very regulated, regimented procedure that we have. We even protect the identity and the anonymity of a lot of people that are involved on the medical team and whatnot, because this is tough stuff to take a man's life pursuant to a state execution order, and we don't want someone touching Mr. Ramirez, and we also don't want verbal prayers to be said, not because we don't think that verbal prayers are important, but in that moment, it will really interfere with our ability to monitor what's happening.
Now, Andrea, as a former prosecutor, this is Mary's co-host, Loretta. As a former prosecutor, I am not unfamiliar with finding God in prison. However,
funny how that happens. Well, however it happens, I shouldn't
yes.
make light of that.
No. I've often said you can find God in prison as well as you can out on the streets, but it seems to happen a lot more rapidly when you are in custody. But I guess, you know, you laid out some of the points, but I guess what is the harm? I mean, I can imagine, but can you tell our listeners what's the harm if this pastor would be allowed in the chamber and would be allowed to touch the person and pray aloud?
You know, that's a really, really great question. And that was what was occupying a big part of the oral argument at the Supreme Court. Interestingly enough, there are a number of states among the 21 states that have the death penalty, where they've said we allow for the pastor to touch, we allow for verbal prayers. That's been actually more frequently identified to be said out loud. There's some indication that in some of the more recent federal executions that there was at least one instance where the pastor was touching the inmate and praying out loud. But it comes to kind of, I guess, the comfort of those that are running this system. You know, are they denying the religious freedom of the inmate? Is there some sort of retributive aspect going on? Or do they have what's in the legal jargon called a compelling state interest? And what they're saying is our interest is to reduce the risk of an interference in this very delicate process to as close to zero as possible. And we think that we can reduce that risk, allowing for the person to be in the chamber, but our risk really is going to be something we can't control if they're touching, if they're speaking out loud. But to back up a couple points before we even get to the issue of compelling state interests and whether there's in the least restrictive way possible the state is serving that interest, which is kind of a legal standard, there is some issue about the sincerity of Ramirez's request in this context. And Justice Clarence Thomas, who I think is a pretty, you know, he's the most senior justice on the bench right now. He's a straight shooter. And he said, is there evidence that Ramirez is gaming the system?
Hmm. Now, is that an unusual question from a Supreme Court justice?
Well, you know, it's not an unusual question when we're dealing with prison requests. We mm-hmm. have something called the Prison Litigation Reform Act that Congress mm-hmm. passed to make sure that there aren't an endless stream of challenging the conviction, the assistance of counsel, that sort of thing. So that is a normal thing for judges and justices to ask. What's not normal is to address the issue of sincerity in the context of religious freedom. Normally, courts assume when someone makes a religious freedom claim that they're being genuine. And the big issue will be, is that assumption one that can be challenged in the context of prison cases by courts? Is it one that the state has an affirmative obligation to basically come up with, you know, the case to challenge the sincerity? It's a delicate move because we don't want to have, in the religious freedom context, having people have to prove their beliefs or even have to say, you know, hey, maybe my church has an official position, but I believe, for example, living my Catholic faith prevents me from doing X activity. We can see that coming out, for example, in issues related to vaccine mandates.
Sure.
So I think it's a really delicate issue. The court was really concerned, and I think they've realized death cases come to the court often in many different requests and always at the last minute. And to be able to come up with a rule, which the court really knows they're not just deciding Ramirez's case, but they're trying to give a rule for all states on how to accommodate religious freedom and at the same time respond to this important state interest of being able to have an execution without risks of botched executions happening.
Now, does the state have the authority to set the parameters, or is there a federal guideline? How do they set up the application of the death penalty?
So that's another great question. Each state, just like each state's prison, that's kind of a state authority, right? But there
right.
are going to be limitations on what a state can do, right? And primarily we know that that's the Constitution. And in this case, when you're dealing with religious beliefs, we've got the First Amendment. We've also got a federal law. And it's got a terrible acronym that's known as RLUIPA. And
it sounds like Chalupa.
It sounds like
rhymes with Chalupa. Okay, go ahead.
Of course, RLUIPA. It's the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. Mm. And it's basically...
Of course. I remember RLUIPA. Yeah.
Of course.
From the bar
RLUIPA.
Exam, I remember that. Okay.
And it's kind of like a mirror image law that applies, like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is a law that we all know about because of the Little Sisters of the Poor.
Right.
But it's in the context of the prison setting, of prisons and jails. So it really does bind the states, whereas RFRA only governs the federal government. This is a restriction on what happens when people are incarcerated. It's the same standard. The state can't substantially burden religious belief, and if they do so, it can only be if there's a compelling state interest and done in the least restrictive means possible. That's a lot of lawyer language.
Yes.
And you really see that when it comes down to kind of practical application, especially in this context, it's tough. Chief Justice John Roberts said, okay, so where does Mr. Ramirez want Pastor Moore to touch him? You know, is it on his heart? Is it on his head? Is it on his arm? And his counsel said, well, you know, he could touch his foot. And that would be enough. And then the next question said, you know, well, what happens when the next inmate comes and said, no, my faith really needs him to touch my heart? You know, and,
sure.
And that doesn't seem like it's made up. I mean,
no,
I could really see if you believe that, or on his head. And it was, I think, Justice Samuel Alito said, you know, we're going to have to brace ourselves for an unending stream of cases at the last minute. Obviously, that's their job.
Right.
But will they be able to do it in a way that's going to vindicate religious freedom and not have these constant stays of execution, which add to the trauma of the family members of the victim?
Right.
So it's a lot more complicated than it sounds on its face.
What's to stop Santeria practitioners from wanting incense and candles burning?
And a chicken.
And a chicken killed. In the room while he's there.
Well, and that was a very interesting thing. I think it was maybe John, Chief Justice Roberts, who said, well, what happens if a prison inmate who's on death row said, look, you know what? I want to change my life. I want to enter into full communion with Catholic Church. I want to start RCIA.
Okay.
You know?
Yes, you're right. So we'll
I really want
stay his execution till April in the church's holiday.
And a lot of these things are difficult. You know, I remember reading some of the briefs right away, and people that I love, religious freedom advocates, were citing, you know, our tradition in the Catholic Church of the Viaticum. And I, you know, quickly sent a note over to my parish priest and said, you know, does that have to be in the moment someone is dying?
Right.
And so I think, you know, these are important conversations about last rites. You know, this isn't a situation where Texas is preventing last rites.
Right.
It's, you know, at a very delicate moment, it's a time where, you know, Pablo Castro's kids are saying, you know, my dad didn't have anyone praying over him.
Right.
I don't think that we want to be lighthearted and say he doesn't deserve clergy care and clergy comfort, but we have to really think, what are the bounds of that?
Right.
And is it, do you think the court would allow, or is it now currently permissible? I'm embarrassed to say I don't know this, for the minister just to be standing in the room, but say over in a corner or to the side, silently praying. Would that?
So that's what Texas is suggesting.
Okay.
And it's a very small death chamber, unlike the federal death chamber, which apparently is, you know, twice as big. And again, when you read all of this stuff, it's just creepy and grosses me out just because it's so painful.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a small chamber. It's a chamber that has, where observers, including the victim's family, are watching, where there's a medical team on the other side that's also watching and listening in. And so there's a concern about, you know, how many people are going to fit into a small area, and they're willing to say, we're going to have, you know, somebody who's not a state employee in there, but that person also needs to have someone from the state watching them, because, you know, this is hard. We don't know how the pastor's going to react.
Exactly.
Right? And you know, so you've got 2 to 3 people already in a very small chamber. It's not easy. And I think each state is got its own setup, its own method of execution, and it does lend itself to a little bit of deference, in my opinion, to the state as to what they can allow and what they think maybe is going to be too much of an interference of something so weighty as this.
But Andrea, then a thought came to my mind as you were discussing the clergy personnel that would be in the room. You know, a lot of people find God. And if you now have a clergy that has a kind of a sketchy background, is this person going to be allowed in and provide a security risk in the room where the death penalty is being applied?
Well, and that's one of the things that Texas has done is they've required the clergy member to sign an agreement as far as making a commitment not to do anything crazy and try to comply to the solemnity of the situation. And, you know, we just have to trust that they're going to do that. They're not going to, you know, try to interfere with the IV lines or anything like that. There are some issues about this particular pastor where he said he would agree to confidentiality and then has been speaking to the press. So the state's really anxious about it. That's why they've in the past had a rule, you know, only to allow state employees, but they're allowing non-state employees to come in there. You know, obviously, if you don't have the death penalty, none of this comes up. But it does say when you do, these are serious issues to consider. We want to make sure that people aren't, as Justice Thomas mentioned, gaming the system, prolonging, you know, basically having fits and starts on when execution dates are set and then stayed. And I don't think it's, you know, it's probably not easy for the inmate either.
No.
To not have a sense of whether there's finality in as far as being able to kind of come, you know, become right with God. So not easy at all.
No, it is not. It is.
Well, just very, very quickly, we've got a couple minutes left here. First of all, thank you. Every time, you know, we speak and our listeners get to hear you, Andrea, they're just, you lay out and you make very accessible what are really kind of very complicated issues at the federal level about these sorts of matters. So thank you, first of all, for that just very concise and helpful analysis. But could you quickly talk about the Maine case, the case from the state of Maine that has to do with religious education?
Yes, so that's coming up. There's going to be oral argument December 8th, Feast of the Immaculate Conception. Awesome.
That portends well, then. I'm very excited about that. Yes.
Maine's got a situation where they've got a number of school districts that don't have public high schools. So they allow for students in those districts to either go to a neighboring public school or to a private school. And they basically, the kid walks with the cost of education. So it's kind of like a voucher.
Right. So the money follows the child.
And so they have a rule saying that the student can go anywhere that they want, except if the school has religious instruction. So there are some schools with a religious identity, but their curriculum is not religious, which is kind of heartbreaking in the minds of the state. And right now, some parents are saying, look, you know, we want to choose, in this case, Christian education for our children, and you're discriminating against that choice. You're interfering with our free exercise rights. Last year, there was a somewhat similar case involving Montana, where they had a provision not allowing for sectarian schools. And so the issue that the court is looking at is the use of this money.
Okay.
What's the name of that case?
It's Carson versus Macon.
Thank you.
So pay attention.
Terrific. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Andrea Picciotti-Bear of the Conscience Project, brilliant attorney at law and mother of 10. Very grateful for your insights. Listeners, thank you for being with us. This hour has flown by, as it always does every Monday. Until we see you next week, goodbye, God bless, and have a great rest of your Monday.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deep for truth or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see? The winds have changed. strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now.